This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 197, Life with the Safeties On. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Zachary Frueling. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including additional shooting for Star Trek Beyond, a special agreement between CBS and Paramount, and Rod Roddenberry joining the new series as executive producer. Then in the feature, we're joined by Matthew Rushing to discuss the DS9 episode, It's Only a Paper Moon. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Zachary. Welcome to the Ready Room. It's great to have you on with me, co-hosting for the first time ever. You've, of course, been on many episodes of this show before, but always during the feature. So welcome aboard.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. It's been a while since I've been on the Ready Room with you. And like you said, never as a co-host. So I'm looking forward to diving in and talking about It's Only a Paper Moon with you today.
Yeah, well, I have to be honest, Zachary, it's been a while since I've been on the Ready Room as well, because with my work schedule and things that are going on, I have not been able to record this show as frequently as I used to, which is something I know many listeners out there are probably wondering about. So before we get into the show, just so everyone who is a longtime listener knows what's going on, I have been in the process of changing jobs. I'm actually going to be starting a new job in about a week from the time that you hear this, maybe less than a week. And during this whole process, things have been kind of tough for me. And this show is very difficult to coordinate with all the guests who come on and all the time zones. So it's been maybe once every 3 or 4 weeks for a while now. I am going to try my very best to get the show back to being bi-weekly. I don't think it will return to being weekly anytime in the foreseeable future like it used to be, because I just can't work that into my work schedule. But I am going to try to get it back to bi-weekly. That's my hope. So everyone, thank you for hanging in here with us on the Ready Room and continuing to listen when we do put out shows.
We know, Chris, it's amazing that the Trek FM network has grown to the point where we have 2 or 3 or 4 podcast episodes coming out every single day now.
Yeah, I know.
So
right?
Even though there's a delay on one show occasionally, in general, we focus on quality over quantity anyway. So, you know, we really do take it seriously here at Trek FM and try to give you the best quality content possible. And if that means we have to do slightly fewer shows for the sake of keeping the quality up, that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, that's very true. So, yeah, it is great that even though the Ready Room has been delayed many times for quite a while now because of my work, there is something new for you on the network every single day, usually 2 or 3 hours of new content every day. So there's always something to listen to. That does make me feel a little bit better. But thank you again, everyone, for hanging in there with me here on this show, which is the longest running podcast that we have on Trek FM. And I do intend to keep it going. All right, so let's jump into news. We've got a number of things that have come up, Zachary, over the past couple of days. The one that probably caught my eye most in terms of something I saw yesterday was the story about Star Trek Beyond bringing in a new character, in fact. It's been reported as them reshooting, but I think it's more like what Dennis Costello, one of our colleagues here on the network, pointed out in the Babel conference. It's more like pickups. They're actually shooting some new stuff for the movie, which will probably help the story come together in a way that maybe they felt wasn't quite connecting, and they felt that they needed this other character. And this is, and I hope I don't pronounce her name incorrectly, this is kind of a hard one here, Shohreh Aghdashloo, who is an Iranian actress who you've seen on 24, as well as The Expanse, The House of Saddam, which she won an Emmy for. And also she played Dr. Kavita Rao in X-Men The Last Stand. So she's all around, and she's going to be coming aboard as the High Command of the Federation, which is a position I've never heard of before. Very interesting. But what do you think about this in terms of, A, bringing in a new character when the movie comes out on July 22nd, and it is currently, as we are recording this, March 13th. And then what do you think about the position of High Command of the Federation?
Well, I think in general, it's such an exciting time to be a Star Trek fan. I mean, think about it. We've got a new Star Trek movie coming out. We have a new Star Trek TV series coming out in 2017. And yet at the same time, there's just not enough information on any of these things. And that, in a way, drives fans a little nuts. And, you know, I think there's two ways to read this. On the one hand, you could view it as an attempt to try to get the movie right. You know, if you're this close to a release date and you're still doing shooting or reshooting or adding new scenes, whatever it is, and I think we don't really know how to describe what this is, the negative way of reading that is, oh my God, they must be worried about something and they're trying to fix it.
And that's what most of the media reaction has been so far.
Yeah.
And fan reaction too.
We've talked about this several times on the network that from our point of view, we're really kind of disappointed at the negativity that's out there around these kinds of news stories. It's such an exciting time to be a Star Trek fan. There's nothing but good news about what the new TV series is going to be like with Nicholas Meyer coming on board and Rod Roddenberry coming on board. And in general, I think there's this angst that's built up around the Abramsverse, right? You know, we desperately don't want them to not get it wrong again. I think a lot of fans weren't excited by Star Trek Into Darkness, and so there's this fear about Star Trek Beyond. So, yeah, but let me just interject there.
I think though that I feel like when I read comments, especially about this story, mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of fans out there that are hoping they do get it wrong again in their opinion, because that would, they hope, be the end of it. And now that we know that there's a new series coming, and a lot of indications on the new series is that it's going to be set in the Prime timeline. I don't know that, and I think it's maybe like a 50-50 chance myself right now, but a lot of people are reading it as maybe it's going to be Prime. I think a lot of people are hoping that this story about reshoots is a signal that they're going to mess this one up too, and then we're finally going to be done with this.
I suspect you're right. I think a lot of fans, probably myself included, and I don't know about you, Chris, but I myself would like to see the end of the Abramsverse with this with this movie. You know, make it a trilogy of movies, make it an interesting experiment. There are some good things, and in fact, by the time this episode of The Ready Room hits the network, we just did an episode of Metatrex talking about Star Trek Into Darkness. There really is some good material in that movie that doesn't get talked about very much. But in general, I think fans would like to see a return to the Prime universe. So, but the positive way of reading this story is that, you know, the people who are making this movie really do want to get it right, right? They're taking the extra time. It's expensive to do a reshoot. It's expensive to call everyone back. It's expensive to spend those resources and create additional scenes, but they're trying to take the time to do it right. And spend the extra resources and time to do it, even this close to a release date. So I think we just don't know which it is yet. Time will tell.
Yeah, and I think that this is probably a situation of them doing pickups, and we don't know how much she's going to be in the movie. They could possibly be just shooting a scene or two scenes that's going to amount to 1 or 2 minutes of screen time in the movie, just to have this character as part of the story and have her perhaps say 1 or 2 things that make a difference to the overall narrative. And it could be just that. And in that case, I don't think it's particularly unusual that they would do that this close to the release date. They can drop it into the edit and you would never know. Like if they never said anything about it and you watch the movie,
you would never know
that it happened late in the game.
I think it's an interesting addition to the cast. You know, I'm not too familiar with the actress's work, frankly, but I think you mentioned there's an ambiguity in what her role is going to be. You know, there's this phrase "High Command of the Federation," which is what made the rounds in the news reports. You know, on the one hand, that could mean Federation President. On the other hand, it could mean something more like a CNC Commander in Chief position in Starfleet. We really don't know what this means. I myself, I'd be excited to see a female president of the Federation. Am I correct, Chris, that we've only seen 2 Federation presidents on screen?
On screen, yes. Now, there was a very long-serving Federation president who was a woman in the novels.
Interesting. So this would be the first female president on screen, and that this is a time when, you know, we might get our first female president in the next presidential election here in the United States. And, you know, it's an interesting time to have a female president in Star Trek. I think it's great.
When if I think about it, maybe we've seen three presidents on screen, two in movies, because we have Star Trek IV, the beginning of Star Trek IV.
Well, that's right.
And then we have Star Trek VI, and then we have Deep Space Nine. And I saw some comments from someone on a thread about this story where they were complaining about, oh, here we go again. It's got to be another human as president of the Federation. Why can't they ever get any diversity? Well, of the three presidents that we've seen, and two of them we saw an extended period of time, they're both aliens.
They're aliens, right? Yeah.
So I think sometimes these fans don't actually think about the material that they say that they are fans of, because that comment contradicts what we've actually seen on screen.
Yeah, I did see some of those comments on Facebook, and I had to ask myself, are these people really Star Trek fans? Have they seen these other scenes?
Yeah, and I don't like to, you know, talk about people and say, oh, are you really a Star Trek fan or not a Star Trek fan? But I do think if you make a comment like that, then you should at least know the material enough to know that what you're saying is contradicting what we've seen.
Well, we can all have short memories sometimes. Yeah.
And Zachary, the president in the novels that I'm mentioning is Nan Bako, who was a human, but she was also a female president of the Federation. And she was in office for 6 years, in fact. All right. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see if high command of the Federation does mean president or if it's CNC, which seems a bit odd because CNC would be of Starfleet, right? Not of the Federation, but
yeah, I guess my worry is that I hope that phrase high command of the Federation is just a quirk of the news reporting and not misunderstanding of the conventions that exist in universe, right? The existing titles and roles, Federation president and, you know, the hierarchy of titles and whatnot. So,
well, you never know in the Abrams verse. So
to nitpick just a little bit. Right?
We'll see. All right. But bottom line on this, I don't think it's a big deal that they're shooting additional scenes. I think it's great that they've realized that they need something else in the story and they're taking the time to add that so that the overall story works better, which I'm sure is the reason that they're doing it.
Yeah, I think you're right. It reminds me of the reshoot of the end of Star Trek Generations, you know, that everyone back and redoing a reshoot, whether we don't even know if it's a real reshoot or whether it's just pickups. But even if it's a reshoot, hopefully that's a sign that the producers are doing the right thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to the next story we have here. And this is about the new series that's coming up. Les Moonves, president of CBS, came out recently speaking at the Deutsche Bank Media, Internet, and Telecom Conference. This was on March 8th. And he said something that many of us have kind of known about, at least it's been a rumor for a long time, which is that there was some sort of agreement between Paramount and CBS about whether CBS could do a TV series while Paramount was doing movies. And apparently that was a real thing. And Moonves said that they had to wait 6 months after Star Trek Beyond before they could launch the new TV series. Here's exactly what he said. He said, when CBS and Paramount split from Viacom 10 years ago, on January 1st, 2006, one of the big sticking points, as you can imagine, was Star Trek. You know, we both wanted it. Paramount said, it's a movie. And I said, no, it's a TV show. Actually, we're both right. So they kept the feature film rights. We kept the television rights. They have Star Trek Beyond coming out July 22nd. Okay, so that part we all know, right? Of course, we know that Paramount has the movie rights. CBS has the TV rights. I will, Zachary, kind of argue that Star Trek is a TV show, not a movie. The movies
I fall
are
in the same camp.
Yeah. Big screen incarnations that occur from time to time of a TV show. It'd be like saying that The X-Files, because there are a couple movies, is a movie, not a TV show, when we all know that The X-Files is a TV show.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. The soul of Star Trek for me is on television. In fact, I love that today on the Ready Room, we're going to be talking about a very character-driven episode of Deep Space Nine. It's Only a Paper Moon. For me, those kinds of episodes, these slower, character-driven episodes are the soul of Star Trek on television. So I think I fall a bit more in the television category. And of course, you know, both of them are money-producing, right? So you do have this question over, you know, who owns what for the sake of producing money from a business standpoint. But the soul of Star Trek for me is Star Trek on television.
Yeah. Same for me. And I think most fans feel that way. That's where the stories work best, because that's where you can actually develop your characters. That's why when we get to the movies, you know, you look at the Next Generation movies, it's Picard and Data all the time. And what happens to everyone else? Well, of course, you can't do a lot when you've only got 2 hours to work with every few years. Okay, well, so Moonbaz went on to say, and this is the important part of the story, our deal with Paramount is that we had to wait 6 months after their film is launched so there wouldn't be a confusion in the marketplace. Now, what is still not clear to me is, was this something they worked out recently when they decided to do a TV series and they knew that Paramount had this movie coming out, and then they talked and they agreed, like, okay, you can do the series, but you've got to wait 6 months after this movie? Or is this a long-running agreement that they had where, you know, you can't do television during a certain time frame surrounding a movie? That's still not clear.
Well, I think the thing that concerns me about this report is that it seems to betray that there's a bit of a different perspective that Paramount and CBS have about the nature of the Star Trek franchise, right? If you own the movies only come out periodically. You can deal with them in a very siloed approach, right? Treat them as one-off entities. Whereas if you've got 750 hours of television to manage and you're producing even more, you're adding to that canon, you tend to it's natural for CBS to think of the Star Trek universe as a much more coherent whole that's ongoing and a bit more smoother development. And this seems to just betray the fact that Paramount wants their own silo to do their own movies in and not and be able to set aside the TV for the sake of doing their own movies. It just says to me that the relationship between Paramount and CBS, either from a business standpoint, isn't rosy, or at least they have different perspectives on what Star Trek means and what to do with it, and they're not on the same page. They don't treat it as a coherent franchise yet.
Well, I find the position, and this is Paramount's position as I understand it, that having a series on TV would create confusion in the marketplace surrounding the film to be kind of odd. Now, it does make me think that the new series is not going to be in the Abramsverse. We already know, they came out and said, when CBS made their announcement, they said that this new series is not connected to Star Trek Beyond. Mm-hmm. And of course, now we know, and I kind of speculated this at the time anyway, now maybe we know why they went out of their way to say that, because Paramount probably told them, you have to say this, right? I'm guessing there. I don't know for sure that that's what happened, but it sure sounds that way now. But, I mean, fans, Star Trek fans aren't going to be confused.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Series and movies.
You know, this sounds like the concern of business people in an isolated room not really being clued into what the perspective of the fandom. It just seems to me, I mean, on the one hand, it's clear that a movie is not a TV show, so there's that, right? They're obviously different things from the very beginning, just kind of by definition. The only situation I could see in which someone might confuse the movie with the television show, if the television show is really strongly tied to the Abramsverse, and it seems clear that we're moving a different direction. You know, this story seems to give us a additional reason to think that the new TV show is if it's not returning to the Prime universe, it at least is going to go in a sufficiently different direction from the movies to where there's not going to be confusion between the two and to satisfy Paramount's concern there.
Well, that's interesting that you say that the confusion might be caused if the series was closely tied to the movie, because I see it the opposite way. I see it that what they could be concerned about with confusion would be not Star Trek fans, but the general audience seeing two very different takes on Star Trek, very close together, one in the theaters, one on television, where the characters aren't the same, the universe isn't the same, there's something very different about it, that maybe that could confuse the average person a little bit about what is Star Trek.
Yeah, I think I have a different take on that. I think it seems more like a concern about who gets the money, right? If the characters and the storylines are too close to each other, then it's a real question. Yeah. You know, if you sell products, I'm thinking action figures and whatnot, and they're all tied to the Abramsverse, then it's a question of who gets that money. Does Paramount get the money or does CBS get that money?
And we know that J.J. Abrams, one reason that he moved on from this is that he wanted to basically take all of existing Star Trek and brush it under the rug and have his own little like Lucasfilm type empire.
Yep.
But at the same time, the licensing is a little bit more complicated, but I think it does still tie into CBS consumer products, as I understand it, even for this incarnation.
But I think you're right. This seems to point to the fact that maybe Paramount isn't clued into the investedness of Star Trek fans. You know, Star Trek fans are so granular and they know every detail of every movie and every TV show. The chance of any serious Star Trek fan confusing the two, I think, is slim to none. So
yeah,
I guess I just fundamentally don't understand the concern from a fan standpoint. Although I think, you know, like a great many things in business, it probably comes down to the money in some way or another.
Oh, well, definitely that. Yeah. I mean, that's what every time I talk about Star Trek Beyond, every time I talk about especially the new series, I always point out that this is a business, right? It's a business. As fans, we just look at the stories, but the studios look at it as a business and they make their decisions based on that and money.
Do you, Chris, feel that this, it's almost a competition between Paramount and CBS where they're competing with each other for Star Trek, right?
It feels that way right now.
Yeah. Do you think that is damaging to Star Trek as a whole and its coherency and fandom, or is this something that will be overcome?
I don't think it's a threat to coherency and fandom, but I do think that it's bad for Star Trek because I think that's one reason why we haven't had a Star Trek series for a decade on television. They've been doing this experiment, you know, the initial stages of what became Star Trek 2009, that happened in 2006. That happened not long after Enterprise left the air. And so we really have been in a decade where they've been doing this experiment in the theaters with a new take on Star Trek. And we've seen it manifest itself in comics and a little bit in video games, although that didn't go very well. But yeah, I think it's bad. I mean, I think Star Trek needs to have one rights holder again, because then they can do movies, they can do television, and there isn't this competition because they can have a unified plan of what they're doing.
And they can do them concurrently. I'm thinking somewhat nostalgically back to the 90s when we had new Star Trek on television. We had Star Trek movies coming out, and these were happening concurrently. And there was a really robust, I mean, Star Trek was everywhere. You couldn't, you'd have to be living under a rock not to see Star Trek somewhere.
Yeah, right.
But now, do you think this agreement, whether it's tacit or whether it's an explicit, long-standing agreement between Paramount and CBS, is this the part of the driving reason that we have to wait 6 more months after Star Trek Beyond, but is this a reason we've had to wait so many years before we've seen a new Star Trek television show?
I think it's part of it. I don't think it's exclusively that, because I think the studio itself had to feel the need to develop a series. I think that Netflix in particular, we've talked about this many times here on the Ready Room, I think Netflix in particular drove CBS to the point where they realized that they needed to revive Star Trek on television. And, you know, Les Moonves has already come out and said recently that Amazon, Netflix, Hulu, they all wanted the Star Trek license to develop a new series. But then I also think it's just the direction that the market is going, where everything is shifting to streaming. CBS is very smartly realizing that their future is not in broadcast television. No one's future is in broadcast television. Broadcast television will eventually die.
Yeah, it's like the just newspaper industry of 10 years ago.
Radio largely has now, right? And so they are trying to establish themselves there. And of course, they want to use their crown jewel, which is Star Trek. It is the most valuable property that they own. Whether it's the one making the most money at the moment, I don't know. But in terms of the one that you can leverage the most, that's what they have is Star Trek. So that makes sense. So I think there are a lot of reasons why we haven't had a new series for the past decade. But I do think that this relationship that resulted from the split of Viacom does play an important role. Yeah.
And I think we, as fans, have every reason to be optimistic. I think CBS, given that CBS is responsible for the television franchise, which is many, many more hours of television, they're invested in that property based around the Prime universe. There's an investment there that it's clear that if either of the two companies, Paramount or CBS, is going to understand the soul of Star Trek, it's more likely to be CBS that understands that Star Trek is a television show principally. And there are these, of course, ancillary movies that come out periodically. But I think CBS, they're making all the right moves here. I think that, you know, some of the people they've brought on for the new Star Trek TV show, there's reason to be optimistic. I should say too that CBS All Access, in addition to Netflix, is the only other streaming subscription service that I subscribe to right now, because I think they're getting a lot of things right. They're putting their massive library of content on that streaming service, and the price is quite reasonable. And I myself I'm already a subscriber. Of course, I would have done that anyway before the new Star Trek show. But I think we have reason to be optimistic, and I think CBS, given these comments, I think, you know, Paramount, if they want to think of movies as a siloed experience and carve out a space for themselves, whether it's for monetary reasons or for some worry about confusing the two properties, which I don't really understand that. But I think of the two, CBS is more likely to have that long-term investment in the franchise as a whole.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think CBS is making really good moves about the new series. I also think that if the new series is very successful, then we might see Paramount and CBS work more closely together, and then Paramount can still do movies in the future, but they'll be based on the series.
Yeah,
and I guess that would make everyone happy, I think.
My one concern about the streaming subscription service for CBS is just the exposure to people who are not Star Trek fans already. I think, you know, clearly the hardcore fans are going to subscribe and experience the new show. But, you know, I want Star Trek to stay a healthy franchise. I want new listeners new viewers to experience Star Trek.
Yeah. And
I worry a bit about not having Star Trek on that broadcast television. I mean, yes, there's a transition. It's an industry in flux, just like the newspaper industry some years ago. The publishing industry is an industry in transition. Now the television industry is in transition. But it hasn't transitioned yet. I worry that it might be a bit of a premature move from the standpoint of exposure.
Yeah, I don't think it's premature though, because I think that, yeah, it hasn't shifted enough yet. But I know from experience with media outlets I've worked with who were in print, they waited too long to transition to online. And before you know it, you are out of the game.
You can get left in the dust, exactly.
Yeah. And so I think CBS is doing this when they need to do it. So, okay, well, let's move on. We have one more quick thing to touch on here before we wrap up news, and it relates to the new series. And I've already talked about this myself on Hyperchannel 142, so you can go listen to that if you want to hear my thoughts in more depth. But I did want to get your thoughts, Zachary, on the fact that Rod Roddenberry has been named executive producer of the new series.
I guess what I don't know is the extent to which this role is an active participatory role or just a figurehead role. Yeah. I think there's something symbolic about having Gene Roddenberry's son be involved in Star Trek, right? I think at very least it makes for a good article, makes for a good headline. I don't know enough about Rod Roddenberry to know really how to read this. I did watch his documentary Trek Nation. And it's interesting to me because the thesis of that documentary seemed to be that when he was growing up, Star Trek wasn't really a thing for him. You know, it was his dad's job. It happened elsewhere. As he grew up, he didn't understand it. By the time Star Trek was having its resurgence in the late 70s, into the mid 80s, into the 90s, he was busy with other things. And he had to discover later in life what Star Trek meant to fans. And it's something he had to learn. And I guess my question is this, if it's an active role, if it's a participatory role, hands-on role in the new Star Trek series, does this mean that he really has that, you know, in deeply ingrained perspective on what Star Trek really means, or is that something he doesn't quite understand himself? You know, from watching the documentary Trek Nation, I think there may be a concern. Maybe he doesn't really understand this yet. On the other hand, you know, it's Gene Roddenberry's son. Who else can give the perspective on what Star Trek meant, at least to Gene Roddenberry, than his son? So I think it could go either way. I don't really know how to read this.
Yeah. Well, I've talked to Rod quite a bit myself, and you can hear some of that on two episodes of a show called Matterstream, which we have here on the network, episode 1 and episode 14. And what I will say is that, I mean, I think Rod understands and has a growing understanding of what Star Trek is to fans. And I think he's very dedicated to upholding his father's vision for Star Trek and for the future and where that was going. And of course, doing it in a way that is appropriate for the time period we live in now. So I think it's a great thing there. I think the role is probably going to be somewhere in between. Executive producer is a title that can be given to someone who's very involved. It's also a title that can be given to someone just basically as an honorary title where you just have their name on something. I think that, as I said on Hyperchannel 142, that from CBS's perspective, it's important to have the Roddenberry name on the show. But I don't think that's the exclusive reason that they're doing it. I think that especially Brian Fuller will want to call upon, and Nick Meyer will want to call upon Rod and get his input on some things. Brian Fuller said, "Gene Roddenberry, the great bird of the galaxy, left a finely feathered nest for all who love Star Trek to enjoy. And it is only fitting that Rod Roddenberry and Roddenberry Entertainment join our new Trek adventure to ensure that his father's legacy of hope for the future and infinite diversity and infinite combinations runs through our tales as Gene Roddenberry intended. And then Rod went on to say, moral dilemmas, human issues, complex characters, and a genuine sense of optimism. These are the cornerstones of Star Trek and are what have made it such an influential and beloved franchise for the last 50 years. While I will always be humbled by its legacy and the legions of fans who are its guardians, it's a genuine honor to be joining a team of imaginative and incredibly capable individuals whose endeavor it is to uphold the tenets of Star Trek's legacy while bringing it to audiences in a new era on a contemporary platform. And one thing I know I forgot to mention in Hyperchannel 142 is that on MatterStream 14, I believe it is, Rod and I actually talked for a while about what it would be like to bring Star Trek to a contemporary platform. Now, this was, gosh, I think we recorded that like 4 years ago, maybe. So Netflix wasn't as big as it is now. You know, streaming wasn't as big as it is now. And we talked about what if it were on Showtime, which is a CBS property, mm-hmm. or what if it were on something like HBO, or what if it were made by Netflix? And so this is something that I know he's been thinking about for a while. So when they came to him and said it's going to be on this service where we'll be able to do things that are a bit different than what we do on broadcast television, I think that probably struck a note with him.
Chris, I'm glad you had that quote from Rod Roddenberry. In fact, I had it written down as well. If you hadn't had that quote, I would have shared it as well. But, you know, I read this quote, moral dilemmas, human issues, complex characters, a genuine sense of optimism. You know, that to me is the soul of Star Trek. So, you know, all the words sound like the right words. Sounds like there's really genuine understanding there. The question then is the implementation of it, right? You know, there's that idea is sounds good on paper. It's a great headline. It's a great article. It's a great soundbite. But, you know, the devil's in the details. You know, is this implemented in a way that really does bring those aspects of Star Trek to life? And of course, it's not up to one individual. And I guess the reason I'm not worried about any sort of headline about this regard is that, you know, the any TV show, any movie is the result of countless people who participate in the creation of that property, right? That of that product. And so, you know, one person doesn't make it, one person doesn't break it. You know, if the whole team really, you know, grasps the soul of Star Trek and they do a good job implementing the stories and what we see in the final product, it's going to be okay. So I don't worry about this at all. It's reason to be exciting. I think you're right. There's something important about having the Roddenberry name attached to it and sticking as closely as possible to Gene Roddenberry's original vision. In fact, it's almost a... I think on the one hand, if you stuck too closely to the original vision of Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry's vision, you may not give yourself the freedom to do something new. So you want to give yourself just enough freedom to, you know, make it relevant for today and explore new kinds of stories.
Yeah. Well, DS9, which we're going to talk about today, highlights that, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, but you, on the other hand, you don't want to veer from the original vision so much that you don't stick to the soul of Star Trek and its original conception. And reality is somewhere in the middle.
So in the end, I think that this goes a long way in terms of media perception. So it's a great move by CBS. So the media can see that, wow, it's actually going to have Eugene Rod Roddenberry, executive producer on it. But I also think that would be selling Rod short for people to think that that's the only reason that they're doing it. So
yeah,
I think that his role will probably be somewhere in between. I mean, I don't think he's going to be super hands-on all the time. You know, that's going to be Brian Fuller. But, you know, I think he'll have some input. He'll be consulted on some things, I think. So it's probably somewhere in between.
Well, these headlines are coming out very, very systematically. First, there was the announcement about Brian Fuller. Then there's the announcement about Nick Meyer. Now there's the announcement about Rod Roddenberry. And I mentioned before that one of my main concerns is exposure, right? I'm worried that people who aren't already Star Trek fans or already subscribers to CBS All Access may not even be aware necessarily that there's a new Star Trek television show. So this kind of media saturation with these very big headlines is a very programmatic step-by-step rollout leading up to what we're going to see in early 2017.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for the next headline to come out that say that they've assembled the writing team and it's Ira Stephen Bear, Ronald D. Moore, and Brandon Braga.
I would love to see that myself. I really would. I'm all about getting the crew back together. You know, we see that in Star Trek movies. Let's get the crew back together and get them on that ship. You know, let's treat the writing staff the same way.
Yeah, get the Trek band back together. So
exactly.
There you go. All right. So the episodes I mentioned here, if you want to go listen to those again, my Hyperchannel about this story, Hyperchannel 142, and then the two MatterStream episodes that I did with Rod are MatterStream 1 and MatterStream 14. All right. Well, that's all we have in news. So Zachary, let's bring Matthew in and talk about It's Only a Paper Moon.
It's only a paper moon hanging over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Now it's only a canvas sky hanging over a muslin tree, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
Events in Star Trek, even tragic ones, rarely have lasting consequences. Deep Space Nine changed that with arcs that took place during the Dominion War. In particular, in the final season, Nog's injuries in battle led to a deep exploration of lasting emotional damage that can stem from a single moment in time, and they did it with the usual DS9 mix of serious commentary and humor. Today we're going to talk about this episode, It's Only a Paper Moon. And to help us do that, we're joined by my co-host from our Deep Space Nine show, The Orb, Mr. Matthew Rushing. Matthew, welcome back.
Yeah, it's great to be back in the Ready Room. It's very comfortable in here, and I don't know who's serving the drinks, but they're doing a great job. This old-fashioned, it feels like I just stepped right out of a 60s lounge. It's awesome.
Well, Matthew, it seems like this episode is made especially for you because everyone who listens to the network knows that you like to sing during podcasts, and I don't know if you're going to be able to resist the urge this time.
What can I say? It gives me fever.
What do you think, Zachary? Are you going to sing also?
Well, to answer Matthew's question, I did bring the martinis, and I didn't forget the two olives.
Oh, excellent choice. Way to go.
Did you go easy on the garnish, though?
the garnish.
I don't like it when it feels like I'm.
That's right.
Eating
I forgot
salad,
about that scene.
You know?
Yeah.
Right.
you don't want to eat your drink. You know.
That's right. All right. Well, before we get into the episode, as always, let's give everyone a quick synopsis in case you haven't seen this episode in a while or you haven't seen it before. If you haven't seen it before, you might want to stop and go watch it before you listen, because of course we are going to have spoilers throughout as we're discussing the actual story. So here's what it's about. Two episodes after the siege of AR-558, the episode in which Nog lost his leg defending a Starfleet base from the Jem'Hadar, the Ferengi ensign returns to the station. With a new prosthetic leg and a cane, he has been put on medical leave and is home to ease back into normal life. But as the crew soon learns, he's suffering from depression and psychosomatic symptoms that lead him to feel pain in the prosthetic limb. Over the course of the story, he lashes out at the crew, including his best friend Jake, when they try to help him overcome the struggles of the trauma that he has suffered. Taking refuge in the holosuite, Nog shacks up with Vic Fontaine and loses himself in the world of 1962 Las Vegas, and also black and white westerns. Eventually, the counseling tandem of Ezri and Vic succeed in returning Nog to real life, though only through some tough love. So that's the basic rundown of the episode. So let's jump in here with our initial thoughts. Matthew, I think you suggested this episode, and then we gave Zachary three choices, and he jumped right on this one. But you suggested it first, so why don't you kick us off with initial thoughts?
Yeah, it was funny. We have this running list, obviously. The Ready Room has been going so long, and so looking through the episodes we have done, and I was struck by the fact that we hadn't done this episode before.
Yeah, I went back and checked three times because I couldn't believe we hadn't done it before.
I did as well. I felt the exact same way. And it was funny because I think this episode came to me as I was looking through all of the Deep Space Nine episodes, and we had recently talked to Aaron Eisenberg, and I thought to myself,
on the Orb,
yeah, exactly. And we had talked at length about Nog and his experiences here, and I thought this would be a great one to really get into. And this episode really has so many different themes running through it that are, I think, big and bold to be tackling. And it's still a very relevant episode, as a lot of Deep Space Nine episodes were. And so I love this episode too, because just for me, and we were making fun earlier, but the music in this episode is something that I'm so familiar with, having grown up in my whole mom's side of the family is from Sicily. There's a huge love for the crooners, and so when they had added that into Deep Space Nine, obviously we always joke, Chris, and they knew that once this happened, the writers said they could do whatever the hell they wanted on Deep Space Nine. But what was so great is just how important Vic actually became to the show, and I think this was the episode that really made that so substantial. Like, it cements him as a character that transcended the level of a lot of even the other side characters, and really kind of became, in my mind, somebody that was, I think, one of my favorite things about Deep Space Nine. Even though, I mean, if we count the episodes that he's in, he's really not in that many, but he has a huge impact. And it's almost like the same way we feel about Garak. You know, he's been in, what, 20 episodes throughout the series? I think we counted one time.
A little bit more, but
Vic's even less, and yet I still think of him as being a major character. And so that's a really... It's so successful how they are able to craft this show to make people seem more important than, not even more important than they really were, because Vic is important, but make it seem like they're there more than they actually were.
Well, you have to remember, for the crew, he's always there, especially after this.
That's true, yeah.
He's always there. We just don't see him so often. So when we say that a character is, it feels like they're there more than they are. It's only in terms of, for us, the viewer, not for the crew.
In fact, he's there 26 hours a day.
That's true. Well, and that's a great point, too, because, you know, that's one of the things about these programs is that they get talked about even when we don't actually see them.
Right.
So they are in our minds as the viewer.
I would also say that Vic becomes a lot like Guinan on The Next Generation, but times 10 or more, right? I mean, he serves a very similar purpose for the crew that Guinan does as the bartender.
Less hat wearing.
Less hat, yes.
And his drinks are a little more earthbound.
Yeah. More light bulb, less hat.
That's right.
All right. Well, what about you, Zachary?
Well, this is an interesting episode for me. It's one of my favorite Deep Space Nine episodes, but that wasn't always the case. During Deep Space Nine's first run, I was really tuned into other things. I had kind of dropped out of the Star Trek world for a while, and then I remember kind of popping back into Star Trek my freshman year of college. I was Deep Space Nine was in its seventh season when I was in my freshman year of college. And I remember just being confused. I didn't understand the Vic Fontaine thing. I didn't really understand what was going on with the Dominion War. I hadn't been tuning in, and it just didn't resonate with me. So it was only later in life that I really discovered, the joy that I find in watching these Vic Fontaine episodes. Like Matthew said, the music really speaks to me. A little anecdote is that I grew up listening to my mom play Liberace albums, and Liberace used to close his shows with "I'll Be Seeing You." So this, listening to Nog listen to Vic Fontaine sing "I'll Be Seeing You" just brings me right back to that particular moment in time, just like you'd expect a song like that would if this kind of music resonates with you at all. But I think
your parents kept coming over to your room and going, "I'm trying to be patient, but you've been playing that song for 3 days.
Turn off the Liberace." Yeah. But the thing that speaks to me most about this episode is that I am, in a way, I'm similar to the way Nog is when he's depressed. You know, I have these, periodic bouts of not really depression, that would be overstating it, but at least melancholiness. And I tend to retreat inward when that happens, whether it's listening to music, whether it's watching Star Trek, whether it's just being lost in my own thoughts. And sometimes I really need the people around me to drag me out of it. I've had, been very fortunate in my own life to have family members or friends, drag me out of these time periods, just like Vic and Esri and the rest of the DS9 crew have to drag Nog out of this bout of depression that he's in. So to me, it just speaks to, anyone who has those kinds of feelings from time to time, depression or melancholy, this episode should resonate. And it does for me.
Well, like you guys, I also am drawn to the music. People who have listened to the network for a long time know that I'm a musician. I used to play professionally, and that was primarily in terms of my professional career. That was in classical music, but I used to play jazz a lot as well, growing up and all through university. And a lot of the songs that we find in DS9 that Vic Fontaine performs are songs that I've played myself numerous times and that I really love. And I think, kind of like Zachary, you said that this maybe originally wasn't one of your favorite episodes. I don't know if it wasn't one of my favorite episodes originally, but I think what I take away from it has changed over time. When it first aired, I was more hooked into the music, like I'm talking about right now, and the more comedic aspects of what was going on in the Hollow Suite, but less so about what Nog was struggling with. But as I've gotten older and I've had more experiences, likely I've never had anything happen to me like what Nog had happened to him here, but I do have other things that really get me down, and I have bouts of depression, and seeing someone try to struggle through that and find their way out and other people trying to help them really does resonate with me. So this is another case of a Star Trek episode evolving for me over time and it continuing to speak to me on different levels as I go through life. So those are my initial thoughts on it. And while we're on the subject of struggling with something that is impacting you, whether it's depression or something more serious, let's go ahead and talk about what's happening with Nog after he lost his leg in the siege of AR-558. That's the starting point of the story. He returns to the station, and he's clearly suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, it seems. Now, I don't want to... I know that's... It affects different people in different ways, so we're not going to be trying to give a blanket assessment of PTSD here, and it can affect people after, you know, physical assaults, or in the case of Nog, something that happens during war. It could affect someone after a natural disaster, like what happened here in Japan just barely over 5 years ago as we're recording this on March 11th of 2011. But Nog does seem to be suffering from a form of that in this episode. And so I do want to discuss how this is impacting him and what we see there. So, Matthew, do you want to start us off here on that?
Yeah. You know, one of the things I think is so interesting is that it shuts Nog down, you know, and he's unable to process or go back to his, you know, quote unquote, normal life. And one of the things I thought was really interesting was, you know, he ends up in the Hollow Suite with Vic and he's watching television. He's watching the old Western Shane. Mm-hmm. And he's struck by the fact that, you know, Shane is in the gunfight at the end, and then, you know, he's shot in the arm, and at the end of the movie, he's riding off, and he's like, but didn't he just get shot? He is not even bleeding. He's not even showing any pain. And I think that, you know, for Nog, you know, I think he's really watched a lot of the people on Deep Space Nine go through a lot of things, and a lot of them have been through a lot more than he has. I mean, he's at the very beginning of his career. This is the first war that he's seen, the first experience with war that he's really had. And he's watched all these other people, I think, be okay, you know, just air quotes there, because, I mean, not really okay after anything like that.
They always find a way out of it, though.
Right. But part of that, too, I think, is that, you know, we're talking about Sisko, we're talking about O'Brien and Bashir and everybody else. They've been here longer, and they've been through this, they've been trained longer. I mean... And so I think Nog is almost afraid to admit that he's not okay, and he just doesn't know how to function anymore in his normal life. And I think it makes it really, really interesting. And he doesn't really know how to turn to somebody and really be completely honest with how he's feeling, because everybody's just going to kind of give him some kind of platitude, you know, and just instead of just letting him talk openly and not actually have an answer to answer back, but just to say, man, I can see that sucks, man. You know, like, I believe you. You know, like, the only person who ever does that to him in this whole episode is Vic, you know, the hologram.
And so when he comes out of the airlock, everyone's kind of joking with him because they're expecting it to be the same Nog that returns.
Yeah.
And that he's going to be happy to be back with everyone. And they don't really anticipate how much this has impacted him.
Well, and I don't think that they're anticipating as well that he won't have been able to process it like they have been able to process things. Mm. You know, and I think this is interesting because what it really does, I think, is shine a light on the fact that recovery for any kind of PTSD is not going to be the same for everyone. You know, and I love that Esri gets into that later, talking about how every patient kind of works out their recovery in their own way, and it can be different. So you need to be okay with that. And one of the things I think overall with the PTSD is that it does a good job of showing that it's not a one size fits all, and it's not necessarily something that gets resolved when you want it to get resolved. It takes as much time as it's going to take, and nobody knows how long that's going to be. So I think this episode actually does a lot of good for the subject matter that's talking about in a humorous, enjoyable way, but it also is not afraid to be very serious about a very, you know, a topic that is really no laughing matter.
Yeah, I think the scene that Matt refers to at the beginning of the episode where Nog is returning to the station and all of his friends from the station are doing making their best attempt to make Nog feel better. They're joking with him, trying to make a little bit light of the situation. And it really backfires, and that helps drive home the point of how isolated Nog feels in the episode. You know, this recovery he has to go through is something he has to do on his own. And I think the thing about trauma that strikes me as interesting here is that trauma, from my experience with it in my own life, there are things I would consider traumatic, you know, maybe not physically. I still have both my legs, thankfully, but, you know, whether emotional trauma or other kinds of trauma. I think the thing about trauma is that it's always there, you know, that, and it's hard for people who haven't experienced a similar kind of trauma to relate. You know, no one else on the station can relate to the fact that Nog has lost his leg. They don't know what to do. They're trying their very best to make Nog feel better, but it's not working. In fact, it backfires a little bit. And, you know, I think of people in my own life who I've experienced with post-traumatic stress disorder. My grandfather, you know, 50 years after World War II, was still very fixated on the role that he played as a B-24 bomber pilot mm-hmm. in World War II. My stepdad, who's a Vietnam veteran, you know, it manifests itself in various ways in his life. And other people who've had similar experiences, you know, have a similar story. It's just omnipresent. It's always there. It's not something you can just brush under the rug or get over. And people who haven't experienced that kind of trauma just can't relate. One of the lines that sticks out to me is in the episode. I'm trying to remember the line, but it's basically Jake calls Nog a hero, and everyone else on the station is calling Nog a hero. And Nog says again and again, "I'm not a hero. Don't treat me like a hero." And it strikes me that if you have gone through an experience like that, where you're fighting in a war, you're seeing people die all around you, you can't focus on the good aspects of what you're doing. You know, that you can, whether it's you've done something heroic, whether there was a good outcome to the war, all you see are the faces of the people you've lost, the people who've been injured around you, the people who've been killed around you. And it seems like you could feel like a failure no matter how heroic you've been. And Nog doesn't want to be treated like a hero.
Well, yeah, I think Nog feels that he failed because he was injured, mm-hmm. especially when he sees his crewmates around him. As Matthew was saying earlier, always find a way to get through this. And then he wasn't able to do it. Then he maybe does feel that he failed his crewmates.
Yeah, you think of the lives you could have saved.
Yeah.
Well, and I think when I was watching it again, too, you know, when Nog gets shot, I think he does a very Ferengi thing to do, which is to scream out in pain in a very high-pitched way.
I think a human would do that as well.
Right.
His scream sounds like a Ferengi scream, but right. I think anyone would do that, yeah.
I think he feels a little embarrassed because he thinks that he should be the tough guy and be able to handle it, and he wasn't that. And again, I think that goes back to him watching the movie and seeing, like, this is how, quote unquote, real men are supposed to handle it, you know, like, but that's not what real life is actually like. You get shot, it hurts. And you, like you said, Chris, you're going to yell. It's painful. So I think there's a part of him that almost feels like he watched those other people to handle that adversity, especially when we're looking at that episode, AR-558, you know, those people had been through the ringer. And I think he really looked up to them. And then, you know, he gets shot and that happens to him. I don't know if he felt like he necessarily lived up to the heroicness of the people he had served with. And so there's also survivor's guilt as well going along with the PTSD. And so it's just, there's a lot going on here. And I love that they don't really pull punches with this. You know, they let Nog really feel what I think any of us might feel if we were in this situation.
Yeah, Matthew, you made a really good point. You know, Nog, he gets taken out his very first time out of the gate, right? I mean, his very first, you know, major skirmish, he ends up injured and having to lose a leg. And, you know, during the episode, he says he wants to challenge himself as a soldier, and he feels like he let himself down, not to mention letting others down. And I love the contrast between where he is at the beginning of the episode and where he is at the end of the episode. Usually Star Trek hits the magic reset button. Next Generation does this, Voyager does this. But in season 7 of Deep Space Nine, you really see some experimentation with exploring the real consequences. You don't get a magic reset button. You get actual consequences. Log has lost his leg and he's got to deal with it. He's depressed. He's got to deal with it. You know, Jadzia has died in, you know, just a few episodes before, and the crew has to deal with it. So just Nog says, you know, he gets asked at the end of the episode, Nog, are you okay? And he says, you know, no, but I will be. And that's very much what it's like to recover from any kind of trauma, I think.
Yeah, I'm glad they ended it that way, because I do think in a typical Star Trek episode, at the end, he would have said, yeah, I'm fine now. Mm-hmm. I'm okay. And the fact that he says no really highlights the significance of what's going on. You know, it's really, the end of the episode is really the starting point for him, because he's decided that he's going to face up to real life and work on recovering. So the episode isn't about finding a way to get him through this and help him recover and then continue on. It's just about getting him to accept what needs to be done. And then that's where the episode ends, and then we go forward from there. In terms of helping him get to that point, we see counseling from Ezri, and we see counseling from Vic. And in Starfleet, Ezri actually is a counselor. That's her role in Starfleet, but she comes aboard the station as a counselor, and we don't really see her performing those duties in the way we would expect. You know, in The Next Generation, we were used to Deanna would bring people in, they'd sit down on the sofa, and they would actually talk, kind of like in a normal counseling setting. And we don't see that, at least I don't feel that that's how Ezri really works. And I think that's in part because she's grappling with her own confusion, because she's become joined when she wasn't prepared to be, and she's very young, and she's trying to figure out what's going on inside her as well. But she does offer advice to her crewmates over the course of this one season that she's on the show, and very important advice. And Matthew and I have talked before at length about how important her role is with Worf actually affecting change within the Klingon Empire through Worf. So she provides a lot of good advice for people. But in this episode, she actually really is playing the role of counselor on the crew. And she's going in and she's being that person who talks to Rom and Lita and, of course, Nog. And she offers that advice. Vic, on the other hand, provides a very different type of counseling. So let's talk about each of them separately at first and then kind of bring it together at the end. So, Zachary, how do you see Ezri's role here?
Well, I think it's clear that Ezri is still learning to be a counselor, right? She was an assistant counselor before she was promoted, and I think it shows she's not as seasoned as Counselor Troi was, and I'm glad you mentioned Counselor Troi and the contrast between her approach, in which people usually come to Counselor Troi's office. You know, they sit down in the chair, they have a very traditional counseling session, you know.
Well, I think she has a calendar, actually, in Space Outlook, where right. She actually has time slots. Yeah, and when that time is up, she sends them out.
Yeah, she does it all from
her. It's been an hour. Sorry, we'll continue this next week.
She does it all from her pad. She doesn't actually do it from a computer terminal, though. So, but she the thing is, unless you're Commander Riker, of course, Commander Riker, he lays down in her office, and everyone else.
Well, he comes in and gets real comfortable, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, they go in. I mean, they do. They have those bubble bath counseling sessions.
Do I need
which
these
are
pants?
Highly sought after by the crew.
But Esri, you know, she goes out to council. You know, she goes to see Garrick when Garrick is claustrophobic, and she goes out into the, you know, the rest of the environment in the station talking to people. And it's largely because I think she's still counseling herself. You know, she's learning how to be a counselor. She has things she's dealing with in her own life, and she has to counsel herself. But in this episode, the thing that strikes me is that she's not only counseling Nog, which is clear, she's also counseling everyone else on how to counsel Nog. In fact, she's counseling Vic. I know Vic is... you know, he's not a counselor, but he's more like your best buddy, right? You know, come on, Pally, let's sit down and let's, you know, see what we can do to make you better. Come on, you know, don't be so depressed, Nog. But she really gets Vic to see that it's not good for Nog to stay in the Hollow Suite. You know, I think Vic is largely very comfortable having Nog there. He's done a lot of work with Nog. He's getting Nog to...
Well, he's going to build a casino, Zachary. Yeah. He's going to get rich.
He's going to get rich. You think if that was his motivation, though, he would have just taken Nog up on his offer to pad the bank account.
Well, I will say with Esri here, though, and I don't want to jump ahead to Vic without finishing talking about Esri, but you mentioned that she's counseling Vic, and I like the way towards the end of the episode that she does show that she's more adept at this, and she really turns the table on Vic and like, oh, I get it. So you're going to get Sammy to tell Nog that he needs to leave the Hollow Suite, right? Oh, you wouldn't let him live out his life in a Hollow Suite, would you? And then, you know, Vic, the light bulb goes on in the light bulb, and then he decides, yeah, I should change what I'm doing here.
That's exactly the scene I'm thinking of. And it strikes me that she's really dripping with irony. She's saying things like, oh, you must have this ploy that, you know, this building, this casino is all part of getting Nog to see that it's time for him to leave the holodeck at some point. And you like you said, you can see the light bulb go on in the light bulb, but it's very, at that point, it's clear that she is clued into what's going on, what needs to happen, and she needs to get Vic to have a realization. And she does it in a very unheavy-handed way. She's really concerned that Vic is going to be too heavy-handed with Nog, that he's not going to be subtle enough, and she's trying to counsel him on how to be subtle with Nog. And he says, hey, you know, do I seem like I'm going to be you know, I forget the term he used, heavy-handed, or going to seem
but that's
pushy.
Where I think Esri's approach failed, though, because in the end Vic does take the heavy-handed approach, and it's actually what was necessary, because Esri's approach, I think, would not have worked in the end.
Yeah, sometimes you need someone to drag you out of that kind of a depression. And, you know, just like Vic kicks Nog out of the club for starting the fight with Jake, you know, he gives him a shove out of the Hollow Suite and back into real life.
Mm-hmm. It was what I loved about the episode is that you do see that Esri is not a bad counselor here. She's actually doing counseling work. And the work of a counselor, you don't always know the best treatment option for your own patient at the beginning. You know, especially with working with a PTSD person like this, you know, because as she said, a lot of times the patient begins to guide their own treatment and what they truly need. And that takes time for the counselor to be able to figure out as well. And so I love how she is very supportive of Nog and his decision about where he wants to spend his recovery time. And, you know, she defends his choice, you know, I think, you know, everybody is making light of the fact that he wants to run away to the Hollow Suite. And yet it seems funny to me that they all think of the Hollow Suite so flippantly since they spend so much time there in their own fantasies and whatnot, and not realizing that this is just a 24th century way of getting away from it all. Yeah. It's just another way of, I mean, you know, it's not like... It would be just the same as if, honestly, he kind of wanted to go to Ryza and just sit around in a villa for, you know, the next six weeks.
Well, Matthew, they could go to Ryza, or they could go to that stupid Viking program.
I was going to say, Chief O'Brien...
Which I felt so bad for you know, I felt so bad for Bashir just getting trounced on by everybody, you know?
I love that scene. I love how they all start, like... They're focused on Nog, and then it's kind of like we do in the Ready Room where we go down a rat hole. They lose focus, and they all just start piling on Bashir about his
And finally, he's like, hey, enough!
do you think Chief O'Brien and Dr. Bashir recognize the therapeutic power of going to play Davy Crockett at the Alamo?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's funny because, you know, that's why I think that Bashir is able to say, look, no, I think that there's validity to this because, you know, I think that he has seen the, like you were saying, the power of being in this setting and getting to express the emotions that you need to express and kind of let go of some things, even though, yes, it is a fantasy. It's not the real thing, as Billy Joel would say. And so I love that, you know, there is the idea of like holographic therapeutic programs is probably not that bad of an idea.
Well, no, it's not, and it will probably be a reality one day.
Yeah.
I mean, the Holosuite, it's the Star Trek equivalent of, in our current world, if you're feeling depressed or you have PTSD or you're looking for a way to retreat into something that comforts you, you might retreat into reading. You might retreat into video games. You know, there are many things that you can do like that, which we see as leisure activities, but you could retreat into them to the point where it becomes unhealthy for you, that you've actually broken your link with reality and you're just immersing yourself in this thing all the time. The Holosuite is just the 24th century equivalent of that.
Yeah, the Holosuite is just, you know, World of Warcraft for the 24th century, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, really, yeah.
But to what
extent
is
Viking program?
To what extent is this episode, you know, the writers and producers of Deep Space Nine turning the mirror back at the fans? You know, I mean, I think all of us Star Trek fans at one point or another probably retreat into this universe we love, Star Trek, that is, it's a fictional world.
What are you talking about, Zachary? Are you suggesting that, like, fans might decide to buy microphones and, like, talk about it like it's real? For hours on end. And,
turn entire homes into Star Trek ships, you know, or...
But that's a fascinating point, because at a certain point, you know, you can treat all of real life as if it's a hologram, right? You can treat, I mean, the things that matter to you in the real world when you walk out your front door are very much like the things that might matter to you inside a holosuite or a holodeck. Nog is very excited about building the casino inside the Holosuite with Vic Fontaine, and that's something he's passionate about. It's an interest of his. He's going to put his energy into it. It's something productive. And if we're going to treat Vic like he's a sentient hologram, and we're going to treat the Doctor like they're sentient holograms, but then dismiss the reality of everything else in the Holosuite, I think that maybe does a disservice to the power of being engaged with something. I mean, the mere fact that Nog is engaged with a project helps drag himself out of this depression that he's in.
Well, and it's really interesting, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking about how he gets challenged at the end. You know, look, this isn't real life, Nog. Don't you understand that? Like, this isn't really real. Everything in here is just fake. There are no actual repercussions for anything. You know, this is life with the safeties on. And I love that. You know, Nog does have to realize that in the end. And so, you know, there is such a reality to this virtual reality, and yet at the same time, it isn't real. You know, the only thing in there that's real is Nog. And
Vic says at one point.
Right. And what I love here is that I think that Ezri sees the opportunity to allow Nog to get more comfortable with his life again in a new way, and in a way that is very safe, so that they can challenge him, you know, when he's ready to move out, you know, to move back into the quote unquote real world.
Yeah, I think the thing that Nog needs to realize is that he's never going to be able to return to his pre-traumatic state, right? He's never going to that sort of safety zone that he was in, that naive zone that he was in as a person with all of his legs and no traumatic experience. That's
gone. Well,
do you think
that's where he's trying to get to?
I don't know. I mean, that's a great question. It seems like, you know, insofar as he had a fairly, he didn't have this trauma, he didn't have this depression before. He was a fairly jovial character. So,
oh, sure, before it happened. But, I mean, my question is, do you think that he's trying to get back to that place, or do you think that he's just trying to find his way to his new future? Because those are different. You're either trying to retreat back to where you were, or you're trying to to shape where you're going.
I think he's afraid. He doesn't see a path. You know, all he knows is what he's experienced before. And I think this may be the heart of the song that's played at the very beginning, the I'll Be Seeing You song that is the theme of the episode, is a song that harkens back to things in the past. You know, your smile and the children's carousel and this more innocent times, and you just can't get back to that. Nog has to realize that life is gone. He needs to find the new post-traumatic life and become okay with it.
Yeah. Well, it is a great choice. I mean, that's actually a song that I sometimes have listened to in the past when I've, you know, become very depressed and feel like things aren't working out and I'm reflecting back on where I was. And that song in particular really connects with me. So yeah, it's a good point and it's a great choice for the song there. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Vic as well. We're talking about him along the way here, but specifically his approach to Nog. I think Vic goes into it feeling like he's just going to help make Nog comfortable, and he's thinking that Nog is going to then figure it out on his own and go, right? It's like a temporary thing for him. He doesn't realize Nog is going to stay for so long, and then Nog starts providing a real benefit for Vic, doing the books, finding out that the government owes him money and that maybe they can actually build a casino and become wealthy. And then Nog becomes part of Vic's life at that point.
You know, what's so interesting is the way in which Vic does have this, it's almost like he has X-ray vision for the human psyche so many times in the show. You know, he's able to see through the kind of 24th century BS that they put out and just get down to the heart of it. And maybe that's just because he comes from a simpler time where, you know, there weren't so many different layers to remove.
I think it's also because he comes from a time where humans actually interacted with each other all the time.
Yeah,
and you had to actually read people face to face, which is something that we've gotten away from even today.
Yeah, that's a great point as well. And so, you know, he can see what Nog needs, and you know what's great about Vic is he already knows enough about Ferengi, so he starts talking about the books and like that, you know, that perks up those Ferengi ears for Nog. I'll look at those later, you know, and he understands the things that are gonna get him interested, you know, because he's appealing to the Ferengi side of Nog, which is still so much a part of who he is.
I'm glad he didn't offer him Umox though.
Yeah, well, whoa, when you said he was gonna shack up with Vic earlier, I was like, whoa, it didn't go that far. And even that with the cane, you know, kind of understanding, okay, how do I get Nog to be able to be okay with not putting as much into the cane? You know, having it be more of an ornamental thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he understands all that, so he does it really well, and it's so understated, but I think the thing that makes Vic different is that he is just kind of a guy, you know, and he can be a good friend, and he can help out, and he can help out in the best way possible. But he begins to get that impact in his life, and like anybody, he doesn't want to start to let that go, even though that's what's best for Nog. And, you know, that's where I think the real counselor, will the real counselor please stand up? It's Ezri. She comes in and, you know, challenges Vic, and her real quality shows through is that she knows what he needs. And, you know, Vic ends up handling it a little bit differently than Ezri thought might be best, but it still works out well in the end. And I like that they end up working a concert together. But Vic just becomes a very rounded character in this episode. He's not just a counselor, but he just kind of becomes a real person, which is kind of a crazy thing to say. Like, more than any AI, I kind of buy that Vic is a real person. I mean, beyond Data, beyond the Doctor, Vic just feels the most real of all of those characters to me. And I think that's what's really cool. It's, yeah, he is not just a counselor, but he kind of has a bunch of, he's so much else going on.
You know, the thing about Vic is that he's kind of doing double duty. He's part buddy or what he'd call pally, but he's also kind of this older mentor figure. And Nog really needs someone like that who can walk this fine line between being told, you know, here's what you need to do to really help yourself, but someone who can just, you know, do something with him, you know, spend time with him, be a friend, be a pal. And, you know, I was told once in life that one of the best things I could do is immerse myself in my work, like use work as a vacation from your problems. And that's kind of what Vic is doing for Nog. Vic is getting Nog engaged. It's not work, but he's getting him engaged in something he cares about. Let's build a business together. Let's re-engage with something. Even if it's something as inconsequential as a HoloSuite casino, it's something Nog cares about. And you can see the fire start to burn in his eyes again, where, you know, at the beginning of the episode, Nog is checked out. He doesn't care about anything anymore. And Vic knows how to spark the seeds of getting him to care about something, however inconsequential, and that of course will lead to eventually getting re-engaged with real life. But getting him to care about something again when he's really checked out, that seems to be what Vic was good at. But it's because he's walked this line between being an older mentor and really being a friend. That's something Ezri can't do, right? Ezri can't be an older mentor figure to Nog. She's a little older, but she doesn't have that she's not programmed with with the years of experience and
well, and Nog needs more like a father figure in that situation, which Ezri can't provide for him either.
And it's interesting that even his own father can't do it on the station, right? It really does take, and I think that's true for a lot of people too. They can't turn to their own parents even. They need someone who is a father figure, but not a father per se.
Well, and yeah. It's interesting too, because I think if they hadn't created the Vic character, mm-hmm. I kind of think that the character they would have used would probably have been O'Brien, because he'd been through a lot of really bad things in the Cardassian War, mm-hmm. And that
well, and
they
I think
have
Nog
that kind of
looks
relationship.
Up to O'Brien as well.
Yes, exactly. So, but they have Vic here, and it enables them to tell this very interesting story, and then it ends up working out really well.
I'm picturing right now Las Vegas Strip with all these hotel casinos with Nogs on the side of them in big letters. Then you can also go to Atlantic
Nogs.
City, see the same thing. Yeah. Yeah. I think the approach that Vic took at the end, I mean, he ended the program and he had the ability to not let it come back on. So Nog is there trying to fix the HoloSuite matrix and get the program reactivated. O'Brien comes in and explains to him, you can't do that, you know, it's up to Vic. He can decide if he wants to be here or not. And then Vic reappears, but only as Vic, not with the surroundings of the lounge, and really just basically kicks him out.
Does that break the illusion? I mean, is that Vic, I mean, he needs to be there as a character to help Nog, but is that Vic trying to really break Nog's illusion by not invoking the rest of the environment?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it also highlights what we've been talking about, how Vic is a person. You know, Vic is separate from that environment, which is unique. But he basically kicks Nog out of the HoloSuite and says, you've got to go. And it's that kind of tough love that I think I don't think that's the right thing to do in every situation like this, but I think in this particular situation, it is what Nog needed. And I don't think Ezri was willing to do it. But she did maybe guide Vic towards that solution.
And Nog was too afraid. He says himself that he was afraid to step out at his front door. If he can lose his leg, he could die tomorrow. And he's just paralyzed by fear. He needs someone to give him a shove out the door and realize, hey, it's going to be okay. You're going to survive that first step out the door.
Well, I think that happens to people in those situations. I mean, hey, it even happened to Alf. You know, they had this earthquake, and then Alf decided that the world was going to end, and then he got Brian really scared, and then Brian started hiding under his bed all the time and wouldn't come out because he thought everything was going to collapse.
And they'll scare two of their friends, and they'll scare two of their friends, and you know, before you know it, everyone's afraid.
Now, that sounds like a pyramid scheme of fear, Zachary.
Pyramid scheme of fear. I love it. You're talking about Alf, Chris.
Isn't that what counselors do?
I'm immediately thinking of, that's almost the reason that Bilbo doesn't go on his adventure.
I'm going on an adventure!
Is because of fear. He doesn't want to walk out that hobbit door because it's scary out there in the world. So, I love this idea, though, that Vic kind of burst the photonic bubble that Nog has been living in, saying, look, this is legitimately not real life, you know? And I love that he kind of just shows up when he does show up, just himself, nothing else in the holosuite but him. And he's like, look, you're the only thing that's real in here. You know, I think that's really fantastic, because I think it speaks to what we were talking about earlier with the larger idea of kind of virtual reality and all that kind of stuff. It's not real. So go be with real people and interact and have consequential relationships. And that's what we get scared of, is the consequences of our actions. You know, for Nog, again, being in the holosuite is a safe zone. I mean, he is in a safe space.
He's in the bubble, yeah.
The safest it can get. There is nothing that's going to happen to him, but life is not safe. You know, it never will be, and that's just the unfortunate nature of our existence, is there's nothing that's truly safe, and you, no matter how much you create safe spaces, it's still not going to be so. And I love that they deal with that head on in this episode, and that it's not good to live in the safe space, you know?
You know, you said that Vic came in and explained to him that this is definitely not real. This is not real. And as we were talking about on the other side of the room,
the other side of the room,
I think that the idea of Vic in this situation would be a good topic for Zachary and Mike to talk about on Matatrek sometimes. The fact that Vic shows back up without all the surroundings, though, shows to me that while the casino and all that is not real, somehow for Vic, there is a reality beyond that.
You know,
right? Something for Vic on the station, it is real life. It is real for him, because if he can come back on his own, first of all, he can control if he's activated or not. He can end his program. He can come and show up without anyone activating him and without those surroundings. There is another reality there that sort of transcends the holosuite itself.
Yeah, it seems clear that Vic is a special kind of hologram, right? In fact, he even says about the holographic band members that they don't know they're holograms, so that, you know, they're clearly part of the illusion, whereas Vic is, he knows he's a hologram, so in some sense he's transcended that. And of course, it raises these issues of free will. How free is he actually versus how much is he controlled by his program? In fact, we dealt with this issue in an episode of Metatrex. I can't remember the number right now, but we did an episode on artificial intelligence. We didn't talk about Vic very much, but we did talk about the doctor. And it's interesting, you know, the contrast between Vic, how Vic approaches his own sentience. And Vic seems very content to be a holographic lounge singer, right? He doesn't really seek to be anything else, whereas the doctor is constantly searching to get beyond his program and, you know, find new hobbies and new interests and reinvent himself. But it seems clear that one of the hallmarks of a self-aware, intelligent, special kind of hologram, when one of these intelligent or self-aware or sentient kinds, is that they know they're holograms, you know, even if they yearn for something more. In fact, Vic, he says about himself, he says he's as hollow as a snare drum. So is that Vic doing a disservice to himself, or is there really no distinction between a hologram, a sentient hologram, and a human in terms of these really essential qualities like free will and the ability to control your own destiny or form real meaningful relationships that really do matter and aren't just holograms?
Well, that's where you have to revisit Vic later on, because when he says that he's as hollow as a snare drum, up to this point, he's only, when his program is active, he's just performing, basically. He doesn't have a chance to do anything else. So I think that he would feel differently about himself later on.
Well, yeah, and especially his, I love when he's like, man, I'm beat.
Yeah, I know, I heard that, right?
He's like, you get the feeling like he has some kind of existence when he's not on, you know, like he's aware that he's not on, but he doesn't get tired or anything like that. But, you know, being on 26 hours a day, as he is going to be from this point on, he will get tired. He'll have to go to bed. He has the limits of existence that all other beings have. They have to eat. They have to sleep. I mean, it might be holographic, but he still has to do those functions just the same way that, you know, I do.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, Matthew, because, you know, for Vic, his eyes are really open. Now that he's on 26 hours a day, he's got a taste of what real life is like, these experiences he hasn't had before. And I think, you know, when you're in this state of depression or melancholy or PTSD, you know, the state that Nog is in, it's easy to forget that, you know, there's a world of possibilities out there. You need to be reminded that you can embrace the joy of being alive. And Vic, he's experiencing this joyfulness. I got tired for the first time, and wasn't that amazing? Now I'm on 26 hours a day. What am I going to do with all this time? And that's the question all of us face. You know, we've got 24 hours a day. We've got 7 days a week. We've got, 50 or 60 or 80 years to live. What are we going to do with all this time? Let's do something amazing with it.
I don't think that, Zachary. I'm not thinking, what am I going to do with all this time? I'm always thinking, why can't I have some more time? Because there's no way I can possibly do the things I have to do.
But the reason you experience that, I think, Chris, is that you're engaged with things, right? Nog at the beginning of the episode is checked out, where, we're engaged with our interests and our hobbies and our work, and it fills up it drains our energy because we're filling it up with meaningful things. And if you're not doing that, life is just empty, hollow as a snare drum. And Vic's getting his first taste of the fact that he can be a real person who's engaged with things. Nog is finding that he can re-engage with real life. And
I'm a real lounge singer.
Exactly.
Well, you see people on, if you pay attention to Twitter, you'll see people who tweet, "I'm so bored." Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I wonder, how on earth?
Well, there's this phrase, only boring people get bored, right? You know, I mean, yeah. People who don't get bored are people who are going to fill themselves up with interests and projects and hobbies and meaningful relationships. And that's what weaves this rich tapestry of life.
Well, let's talk about one more thing here before we wrap up with our final thoughts. And we've talked a lot about the music, and of course we've been talking about reality here, but the one thing that we haven't talked about is the fact that this episode was originally nothing at all like this. So the episode was originally pitched before the siege of AR-558, and so Nog hadn't lost a leg and they didn't have this kind of story to go on. But still, this is an episode that focuses on one specific character. And the original idea was actually for this episode to have three concurrent plot lines, all taking place in Vix at the same time. And at one point, those three lines were going to be two comedic stories and one serious story, with the serious story being Nog's, as I understand it, although I guess originally it wouldn't have been the story about his leg because that had not happened. Though, as I understand it, maybe at one point they were going to talk about Nog's leg, but the idea of having the two other plots in there was still there. And in the end, in terms of comedy, I think that they do a wonderful job in this episode, as they often do on DS9, of mixing in just enough comedy to keep the episode from getting too heavy. There are points in this episode where you can literally laugh out loud, even though it's dealing with a very heavy subject, but it's never played straight for humor. You know, they're not trying to make a funny episode. Can you picture this episode, however, having three stories going on at the same time and having part of it be intentionally designed to be comedic? I mean, what do you think, Matthew?
That would be really hard. Possibly just because I think that if you had tried to take away any time that you were giving to the Nog storyline with something else, you would feel cheated, especially if, it's about him dealing with this loss of leg and then you have these other funny things happening, especially happening in Vix as well. It really would feel like you're doing a disservice to what you're talking about. And, they are able to pull away from the Vic storyline and, go into the wardroom where they're talking about the therapy and then they're making fun of Julian and all that stuff's funny, but it's still very much about what's happening with Nog, but they're able to create a more lighthearted moment. And it all works more in concert, whereas I feel like if you had tried to put too much comedy into this, you really would have just destroyed the ambiance of this story that you've created. And like you said, Chris, I think the use of comedy is sparing here, but when it is there, it matches perfectly with what's happening with the rest of the storyline. And it's really woven together with a storyteller's genius, I'd say, because I imagine then trying to move around pieces in this episode in my brain to make it work with something else, it just starts to fall apart. And you can see why they came to and made this decision. I think it's the wisest decision they could have made, is they found the focus of this story, and the focus is the Nog storyline, and everything else needs to service that instead of it being, let's try and create some other kind of comedic timing or storyline. I mean, three other concurrent plot lines. Whew, that's
I think
not
it would
good.
Get way too busy. And like you said, they need all the time that they have in this episode to talk about what's happened to Nog. And there's really no room, in my opinion, for any other story except what's happening with Nog. So even if there were only two stories, your usual A-B plot, I think it would have hurt the episode. And I cannot imagine three. But what do you think, Zachary?
Yeah, I agree with Matthew. I think if you had anything that detracted from the screen time that's given to Nog and the situation that he's in, that would detract from this emotional impact that the episode has. And, you know, for me as a viewer, I relate to Nog because you're sitting there and sort of feeling his loneliness in the slow pacing of this episode. And, you know, if you try to weave in too much, it just detracts from that emotional impact. But for me, I was thinking it really a day at Quark's really sounds like a day at Cheers or something. You know, you got Morn sitting there on the bench and someone walks in, everyone says, "No, Morn." It's too much of a, it would make it too much of a comedy episode. And, you know, this episode really needs the emotional impact. And I don't think I really need to see Cheers turned in, or Quark's turned into Cheers.
Yeah. But I think, like, we have Morn on DS9. I think that we needed to have a character named Filk who just sat there at the bar and just spouted meaningless trivia at people. Then we would have had the full Cheers experience.
You know, that original concept also reminds me of the episode Data's Day from Star Trek: The Next Generation. Just the idea for a show of just following around a single character or a single environment for an entire day. You know, it sounds like something that's already been done. It was interesting to see, you know, what Data's Day is like, all the minutiae and the trivia of Data's Day, the things that you don't see when there's, you know, action unfolding on the bridge. And in Quark, sure, of course, there's going to be all kinds of stories. I'd love to see an episode about the situation of the Dabo girls, or I'd love to see an episode about you know, some bit character we don't see in how Quark turns into a counselor. I could see Quark being a counselor like Esri or Vic. That would make Quark in that counselor role. And he does that sometimes, yeah, but this would really drive that home.
But Quark's counseling fees are really high.
Yeah.
You know, they were also going to do an episode on TNG called Riker's Day, but apparently it couldn't get by the censors.
Whoa, that's...
Yeah, the whole thing took place in the dark.
Yeah.
Riker after
so,
dark.
I'm glad, Zachary, that you mentioned the pacing, because originally on our outline, I did have a separate element called quiet pacing, and I removed it just in the interest of time. But as I was watching the episode, I think one reason this episode is very powerful in terms of addressing depression and PTSD and what's happening to Nog is the fact that the pacing is very slow. By the time he goes into Vic's and asks Vic to perform "I'll Be Seeing You" for him, we're already like 12 minutes in, and you kind of feel like almost nothing's happened yet in this episode. And when you reach a point where they decide to build the casino, I believe it is, there are only like 13 minutes left in the episode at that point. So the pacing is very slow. It's a very quiet episode in that sense. And I think it's really important.
There's kind of an existential tedium to the episode. I mean, there's nothing that happens in it, right? It's all just Nog in the holosuite and some little events, but a lot of life is like that. You know, I mean, you get up and you brush your teeth and you go to work, and you know, most of life is not live action shot to action shot or dramatic scene to dramatic scene. You know, the real life happens in the middle, and I like the pacing. I think a lot of life is like that. It drives home the emotional impact. And for me, Star Trek for me is often my relaxing snack at the end of the day, or you know, something I'll watch before bed. This is an episode I would put on before bedtime. I find it a soothing episode of Star Trek.
There's my wife and I just went to a concert the other night, and the artist has a song, and one of the lines is, "Life is not the mountaintops; it's the walking in between." Mm-hmm. You know, and that's very much what we're getting here, is the in between times. You know, for Nog of dealing with an issue, you know, and I think that when you talk about like character development for most people doesn't come with, like you were saying, an action shot or, you know, something like that. It comes in these small moments of dealing with tough things, usually, because that's usually when we grow the most. We don't grow when things are fun. We grow when things are tough. That's when we show our true character, and when so many of us show how much character we still need. You know, I speak from personal experience in that. So, you know, I think that's what's so great here is that to take your time to tell the story right, it's not going to be flashy. It's not going to be really funny. It's going to be more soulful. And this episode, again, to quote Billy Joel, is all about soul. And what I really love this is we're fighting for the soul of who Nog's going to be now after one of the most traumatic experiences of his life. And I think it comes across really beautifully because they don't rush it and they don't play fast and loose with it. They treat it as this with the same importance as a real person dealing with PTSD.
And I love that Nog's inward self-introspection is not an easy journey. I mean, this is not an easy journey for Nog. And most of the really important lessons in life are not easy lessons to learn, I think. And we get to see some of the hard work of Nog learning a deep lesson about life and about himself. Whereas you could very, if we tried to weave in two other plots and have three plots in this, you wouldn't see that hard work of the introspection. Nog has to go through a really real battle. Not to mention the battle of losing your leg in the first place, the physical battle. You get to see the emotional, mental battle. And that's just not an easy journey. And I think all too often in fiction, you see, you know, there'll be a situation, you'll see a character who will learn a lesson. You'll go, oh, I'm glad I went through that hard situation. I just learned a lesson out of it. And then on they go. And you get to see the hard work of Nog learning a lesson. I like that about this episode.
Well, and you know, one of Vic's songs would be Night and Day, you know, and we're really getting to see the night and the day that are involved with going through something like this. You know, I love that the episode really gets going, as you were saying, Chris, in the middle of the night when Nog can't sleep, he can't focus. All he wants to do is listen to this song. He gets kicked out of his bunk because his bunkmate's like, I can't take that song anymore. And so he goes to the only place he can get it, you know, without annoying everybody. And it just continues on from there. And that this is a night and day process. It takes lots of time and you have to just let it have its time.
But you have to sympathize with Jake a little bit. You know, if you're not in that situation and you got someone around you who you know is not living up to their potential, or you know is dragging something on too long, eventually you just have to grab hold of them and say, snap out of it already, like Cher in Moonstruck. Snap out of it. You know, you need someone to do that. So I sympathize with Jake. He just wants Nog to get over it. And it's not that easy, of course, but you can kind of sympathize that Jake's not on the same journey and he cares about his friend. It's a similar kind of tough love. Stop playing that stupid song. You're being self-destructive at this point.
Well, he took the isolinear rod with him too, so he couldn't play it anymore.
Yeah, he doesn't have backup files, so
apparently not.
Yeah, they don't.
And he doesn't have a cloud server. Can't stream. Yeah. It doesn't come from the cloud. Yeah, so
yeah, they don't have Spotify.
Matthew, you keep quoting Billy Joel, and as we talked about, one of the original ideas for this, A Day at Quark's. I can go a little bit more obscure, and I think they could have still used a song title for the name of this episode, Scenes from a Ferengi Restaurant.
Oh, nice.
It also sounds a bit like Piano Man. You know, everyone that walks in the door has got a certain story, right? The three of us sitting here at
apparently
our microphones.
It's a Billy Joel bonanza here.
Our microphones all smell like martinis.
All right. Well, let's get ready to head into final thoughts. We've passed an hour here. One thing I did want to point out, Matthew, because you host Literary Treks, which I, of course, used to host with you, and you're still on there. This is one of those Star Trek episodes that was written by the literary team. Of course, John J. Ordover, who was the editor at Pocket for a long time, and our friend David Mack.
Yeah, that's right. I love seeing their names pop up here for the story today here. And, you know, those guys are really fantastic and been responsible for some of the best in Star Trek lit. So, you know, I encourage you, if you haven't read any David Mack stuff, start with Destiny. Just pick that up and check out all the interviews we've done with him on Literary Treks. So you will not be disappointed for the genius that David Mack is. And of course, John Ordover with all of the work that he did with the editing for Pocket for so many years. Those guys are just fantastic. So I love that when I see the credits for the authors that really got the opportunity to work on the show just a little bit. It's fantastic, and they totally deserve it.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, final thoughts and ratings. So, Zachary, why don't you go first?
Sure. I don't want to sound too much like a broken Vic Fontaine record, but for me, this is as close as you get to a perfect Star Trek episode. And the irony is that it doesn't take place in space very much, right? We basically, the entire episode takes place in the holosuite or with a couple of ancillary scenes. But for me, it's just a calming, relaxing, in-depth dive into character development. And I can relate to Nog insofar as, you know, he's got trauma. I've experienced trauma in my own life, and I know the hard work of trying to pull yourself out of it, and sometimes you need other people to help you do that. So when I watch this episode, it puts me in a very introspective mode. And I like that introspection. I think it's part of what it means to be a well-rounded human. You can avoid the introspection. You can, you know, lock yourself in a holosuite or get lost in something that doesn't matter. But this episode really drives home the point that it's important to get yourself out that front door and make something happen, and even when it's difficult, even when it's hard, even when you have, even when you're damaged in some way. You know, life is out there waiting for you, and if you run away from it, you're going to miss it, and it'll be too late. And Vic makes that point to Nog that, you know, you're going to waste your, you're going to die a slow death in here. You're going to waste your life away. Get out there and live in the real world. And so I just love the existential kick in the pants that this episode gives you when you focus on that introspective element. So it's one of my favorite episodes. I think for a rating, because I love it so much and because it speaks to me so much, I'm going to give it my first 10 out of 10. Rating here on the Ready Room, 10 out of 10, Vic Fontaine's greatest hits.
Wow. Excellent. How about you, Matthew?
I am going to sound like the broken record because it is, I think this episode is practically perfect in every way. It does everything that you want a good Star Trek episode to do. It dives deeply into character. It makes us think about so many different themes and issues, from the idea of dealing with something like PTSD or we didn't even talk about it in the episode, but the way in which music therapy can be so helpful for people. Music mm-hmm. actually has the ability to help you come out of, you know, so many things. And I think of the old Trisha Yearwood song, the song Remembers When, you know, music has such power that it can hold such memories for us or to move us to emotion. That's just an incredible thing. The idea of dealing with reality we really can't find safety, even as much as we want to hide. You know, look, you're still going to die. How do you want to die? Do you want to die alone in a world that means nothing, or do you want to go impact the world in some way? It's all incredible, and I feel like this episode, it flies you to the moon and it makes you sing among the stars without actually feeling like we're in the stars. You know, we're very
earthbound.
Don't
forget, Matthew, it also does that just in time.
That's true. It does just in time. I found you just in time.
Flies you to the paper moon.
Yeah. Chris, you're going to get me going. but all that said, I would give this a perfect rating of one immaculately carved lion head's cane. So,
oh, wow, yeah. That's fancy. Well, yeah, I don't have a lot to say about this that I haven't already said. I think it's a very powerful episode. I think it's a perfect example of what DS9 does so well, which is to talk about very serious topics, but to do it in a way where they mix the commentary in with just enough humor that the story connects with you. And they don't give you easy answers to things, and they don't wrap it up with a bow at the end. But it's something that you can watch and you can see yourself in it, depending on where you are in life and what's happened to you. And you can certainly see Nog's perspective. You can see Vic's perspective. You can see Rom and Lita's perspective. It's just a really, really well done episode. One little bit here that I never noticed this before because it goes by so quickly, and I've seen this episode so many times. Did you guys notice that Vic calls Nog Noggles?
No, I missed that.
Yeah. I have seen this episode so many times, and then I'm watching it again last night, and I'm like, did he just call Nog Noggles? But it's in there, and I can't remember the exact line now, but it's just there. It's after the performance, and Vic's saying something to Nog, you know, you got to do this, and he's like, you know, just face it, Noggles. I'm like, did he call him Noggles? So I rewound it. I'm like, yep, sure enough, Noggles. So that was really cute that there is a nickname for Nog.
Noggles.
So, you know, we call Julian Jules. Now we can call Nog Noggles if we want.
Yeah, that's the name
so.
Of the casino in Vegas, Noggles.
It's established there.
Noggles, I love it.
Noggles
big,
Casino.
Yeah,
all
lights.
The buildings say Noggles on the side. They get really rich. Nog has his own plane and it has Noggles.
Yeah, you
written
can get your souvenir poker
too.
Chips, Noggles, you know.
Right. You could even do a kids show, The Noggles. So anyway, great episode. I'm going to give it 10 tickets to Tahoe.
Excellent. To see Sammy. Yeah.
To see Sammy up there at the Cal Neva, which I've driven by many times in my life, actually. All right. So, well, thank you, Matthew, for joining us today here talking about DS9. Before we go, tell everyone where they can find you around the network and the interwebs.
Oh, gosh, when I'm apparently not talking about or singing song lyrics, you can find me on Twitter. I'm probably tweeting about them at MattRushing02. You can also find me on The Orb with Chris talking about Deep Space Nine. We love doing that, and we talk a lot about all of this kind of stuff. So if you enjoy this kind of conversation, please join us over there. I'm also on Literary Treks, as we've talked about, with Dan, talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We also interview the authors, as we mentioned. David Mack is featured there prominently, talking about so many of his works, as well as the other authors. So check that out. You can find me on the 602 Club, which is our general geek show. We hang out at the 602 Club. Ruby serves great drinks, and we talk about all the other fandoms that we love. So if, and I know that if you're a Star Trek fan, you probably like a lot of other fandoms. So join us over the 602 Club each week as we pick up a new geeky topic and talk about that. And then I have a brand new podcast with my friend John Mills. We talk Star Wars. It's called Aggressive Negotiations, and you can find that on iTunes at Aggressive Negotiations.
And Matthew, speaking of the orb there that you mentioned, and you mentioned this during the show, but I wanted to tell everyone, if you want to hear from Aaron Eisenberg directly about some of the stuff we talked about, tune into the Orb 95, which we did back last October. We actually had Aaron on the show. And if I remember, Matthew, we did talk
about
this.
Yeah, we did. We talked really in-depth about Nog's growth, and we talked a lot about this, and it was great to get his perspective. So definitely check that out.
Yeah, that's the Orb 95. All right. Well, thanks again, Matthew.
Yeah, it was great.
For joining us. Well, Zachary, that was great talking about It's Only a Paper Moon. I'm glad that you picked that one of the three options that Matthew and I gave you, and I'm glad Matthew suggested it because it's just such a great story.
Yeah, I'm so glad we had a chance to talk about this episode. It's always been one of my favorite episodes. This is my first 10 out of 10 rating for an episode here on The Ready Room. And of course, Matthew and I and you had a great discussion covering the ins and outs. And like I said at the beginning of the show and throughout the episode, this is an episode that speaks to me personally. I can really relate to Nog in a great many ways. And it's an episode with heart to it. And it's not just an action episode. It's not full of lots of drama, but it's full of rich introspection that really works for me.
Most definitely. Well, the struggles of Nog and the counseling prowess of Vic Fontaine are not the only things we've been talking about here on the network recently. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
The Wadi, a fun-loving race from the Gamma Quadrant, arrive at DS9 eager to play a game with Sisko and the crew, one that appears to be a matter of life and death. All right, so are we moving along, Matthew?
Oh, we're moving along.
The Ready Room.
He's carrying in the lamb chop sock puppet, saying, "She stayed at her post."
While Charlie Horse ran.
While Charlie Horse ran.
To the journey!
My last one, I think I might get a little bit of grief from you. Workforce, part one.
Oh my god.
I know. Hey, I did not make fun of Fairhaven.
That's because Fairhaven's good and Workforce is boring.
Oh, bite me!
Commentary, Trek Stars.
You know, you come up with something stupid because of some joke that someone said and someone else said, and then all of a sudden you're doing a tournament of movies which J.J. Abrams produced to determine which one is the crappiest.
The 602 Club.
We start getting hints of Thor, we start getting hints of Cap, we start getting hints of the entire Avengers crew, and we get Black Widow. So, I mean, Iron Man 2, considering how maybe that's not my favorite movie of the MCU, really does set up a lot of what is to come.
Literary Treks.
You know, visually, to me, this is one of my favorite eras of Star Trek. You know, those monster maroon coats they're wearing, and they're just absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, a lot of people talked about wanting to get a Captain Sulu Star Trek series, and one of the big reasons for me that that would be so great is to see this era played out visually on a regular basis.
Women at Warp.
Her voice as a computer voice has become so iconic that when Google started developing what is now known as Google Now, that personal assistant you can speak to, they had initially codenamed it Google Majel.
That's so cool.
Isn't that awesome?
Meta Trex.
And I kind of had the jingle in my head, you can be a winner at the game yes. of life. And I was trying to think of the Star Trek version of that. You know, you can be a winner of the poker game of life on the Enterprise. It didn't really roll off the tongue, so.
It was great until you added on the Enterprise.
Melodic Trex. The reason why I think Brian Reitzel would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzel's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
One of the characters is sizably larger than the other.
Yeah, he's just closer to the camera, Aaron, obviously.
But he's actually behind the other person.
He's a giant.
Wait, then he doesn't need a laser cutter. He can just lift the hatch up with it. Go down and get it.
Okay.
Continuing mission.
Yeah, and of course, another great thing is when it's all finished and you look at it and go, yeah, we made that together. Yeah, that's one of the greatest moments. And people respond to it and say, oh, that's pretty well made. The effects are great. The actors are great, even though they're Dutch trying to speak English, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about on the network. We are covering every corner of Star Trek. Pretty much anything that you love about Star Trek is going to be talked about on one of our shows. You can sample everything that we're doing in the Trek Up Film Master Feed. That contains every episode of every show, plus some additional things that aren't available in the other feeds. And you can find these everywhere that you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes, where we're a featured content provider, and we have a whole artist section. You can also find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. You can go to the website, stream from the show pages, download the MP3 files, or grab the RSS links. If you use a third-party podcatcher on your phone or your tablet, just search for trek.fm, and we should come right on up right there. Now, we would love to hear your thoughts on It's Only a Paper Moon, and the best place to do that is in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Zachary, tell everyone really quickly a little bit about the Babel Conference.
Yeah, the Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. It's a private group on Facebook. If you go to Facebook and just type Babel into the search field on Facebook, that's B-A-B-E-L, the Babel Conference will come right up. It's a private group. Just hit join and someone will let you right in. And I just want to give a bit of a plug for it. It's a Trek FM-only discussion group, and we really make a conscious effort to keep the discussion friendly and civil and engaged. And it's a great place to meet other Star Trek fans, to meet fellow listeners on Trek FM, to discuss anything we've talked about on any episode that you listen to here on Trek FM. So, you know, I recommend it highly. I think it's a good contrast to what you see in other Facebook groups. We really make a great effort to keep things civil and friendly and engaged, and it's a unique environment we've created.
Yeah, we do ask everyone to please do that. So, you know, we sometimes have people come in who just want to start arguments. It's very rare. And those people, we do explain the rules, and usually they wander off to another Facebook group where people will argue with them, because we like to do, as we do on the shows, have meaningful discussions about Star Trek. So again, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right on up. And on our website, you'll see a link for discussion underneath the streaming player on the show pages. And if you click that, that takes you over there too. Now, I know not everyone is on Facebook, so if you're not, there are other ways that you can get in touch with us. You can, of course, send tweets. The username for the network is TrekFM. You can also go to our website at trek.fm/contact and use the form there. Choose to send to a show, choose the ready room, and that'll come to me by email. And you can also send us a voicemail by going to speakpipe.com/trekfm. That's the word speak and the word pipe.com/trekfm. And you just need the mic on your phone, your tablet, or your computer, and then you can record a message and upload it. So it's like voicemail, but it's free. There's no phone number to dial. So that's pretty cool. Zachary, if people want to find you, you know, when you're not there thinking about the bigger picture of Nog's situation, where can people find you on the network and elsewhere on the interwebs?
Yeah, you can find me as one half of MetaTrex, that's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host Mike Morrison. You can also find me on several previous episodes of The Ready Room, and I've done a couple of episodes of our 50th anniversary rewatch podcast, From There to Here. You can always find me in the Babel Conference. We mentioned that already, Trek FM's listeners group, if you want to talk Star Trek and specifically Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can always find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZachariFruhling. And Chris, why don't you tell our listeners everything about your projects these days and where they can find you around the network and everything you're involved in?
Well, I'm still around the network here. I'm often doing things behind the scenes these days because my work is taking up so much time, but you can find me elsewhere on the network, as Matthew mentioned, with him on The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. You can also find me on Hyperchannel, our news show, and then you can also find my writing over on the official website at StarTrek.com. Yes, I do write sometimes, although most of the time I am here behind a microphone. And if you want to find me on Twitter, my username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my username on Facebook and pretty much everywhere. And then you'll find me there in the Babel Conference. Zachary, when I was listening to you spell your name for everyone there, I was going to tell you, you know how I remember how to spell your name?
I'm afraid to know.
In Text Expander, I have it set up so if I type ZF, it expands into Zachary Fruhling.
Yeah, it's a difficult name. It's a difficult name to spell, right? So I try to help listeners out.
Yeah, that's how I remember. So there you go. All right. Well, while we're talking about feedback here, we did get a message that I wanted to share, and this is from Janet Lee. And Janet wrote this. It's been a little while now. Again, the Ready Room hasn't been coming out as frequently. So Janet, sorry it has taken us so long to mention your letter here on the show. But she writes, "It's always interesting when different podcasts on Trek FM have radically different opinions on the same topic. In the Ready Room episode on Damage, Matthew and Colin had a positive view of T'Pol's drug addiction. This was not the case for From There to Here with Will and Sue, which had a negative opinion, which Jolene Blaylock and I happen to share. I give Jolene a lot of credit for acting her heart out while not liking the storyline. Also, the Ready Room and Warp 5 had all Trip T'Pol shippers when the topic of romance came up, which seems to make up a majority of hosts and guests. But the Trek News and Views episode on Archer only had Archer T'Pol shippers. Is this difference of opinion between shows just coincidence, or do people who think alike form their own groups? What are some other controversial topics among the Trek FM staff? One area everyone on Trek FM seems to agree on is the portrayal of Vulcans on Enterprise. If American views on conformity and racism were different just 50 years ago, of course Vulcans were going to be different when the gap between Enterprise and TOS was bigger. I can't understand why this was so controversial. But this is also the reason I'm not a fan of Manny Koto making T'Pol half Romulan in Season 5 to explain her emotional nature. Why can it be that Vulcans have all different levels of emotional control?" All right, so I'm going to make just a couple of quick comments on this one, and then I'll get your thoughts, Zachary. In terms of, is the difference of opinion just coincidence, or do people who think alike form their own groups? On the shows, it's just coincidence. I mean, we have on air and behind the scenes, and the people who are behind the scenes do appear on some shows as guests from time to time, as well as on From There to Here. We have about 35 people now, I think it is. So obviously when you have that many people, you're going to have a really wide range of opinions. And that's why we strive to uphold the principle of IDIC on the network, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And I saw someone post something, I think this was in the Babel Conference, but it may have been elsewhere recently, about IDIC that I think was really important. IDIC doesn't mean that you like everything. IDIC means that you understand that there are different ways of looking at something and that there are different opinions and that you respect that different people have different opinions. I think sometimes fans think that IDIC just means that, well, I have to like everything just to be nice, right? And that's not what it means. So yeah, we have a wide range of opinions here on the network. And shows like The Ready Room and Trek News and Views, when that was on, when Colin was doing that, and even From There to Here, these are shows where we're really bringing together random groups of people all the time. You know, The Ready Room here, if you go through and you look episode by episode, we have a huge mix of different people. And so we're going to get different opinions in that situation. As for what are some other controversial topics, boy, that's just something too big for me to get into here right now at the end of the show. I think it would be a great question for the Babel Conference. You know, start a thread in the Babel Conference about what are some of the more controversial topics amongst Trek FM hosts. And we'll see. So there was that point, and I totally agree with you, Janet, on the point about Vulcans. Of course, they're going to be different at that point in their history. I remember when Voyager was being developed and people were upset about Tuvok being a black Vulcan. And I didn't understand at the time why that was such a big controversy either. I mean, we know on our own planet why there are different pigmentations in skin. You know, it depends on a variety of factors, one of which is just climate. So why would that not happen on another planet? You know, it doesn't make any sense why that would be controversial. And of course, Vulcans being different in the past and being more emotional. I mean, we know from Spock that Vulcans have this history in which they were very emotional and it almost destroyed them and they decided to suppress their emotions. So it's natural that you would show Vulcans at a time where maybe they were struggling with something like that. So those are a couple of quick points here. And, you know, my view of T'Pol's drug addiction is well documented on Warp 5 because I used to host that show. So you can listen to things there, especially the episode about T'Pol. Well, Zachary, you have any thoughts on Janet's letter here?
I do. I think that one thing I'm really proud of about Trek FM in general is our ability to combine different perspectives and different personalities and do a deep dive into whatever issues are the topic of the day. You know, whether it's something like on our own show, Metatrex, my show with Mike on Mike Morrison on Star Trek and philosophy, we do a deep dive into controversial philosophical issues. And, you know, we on the one hand, we have a similar perspective and a similar background. We're both interested in philosophy. But on the other hand, you know, we don't agree all the time. We have different perspectives on these controversial issues. But the key for me is always having a sort of respectful approach to disagreement. You know, what we don't want to do is let those disagreements devolve into arguments. And I think we're proud of the fact that we've created this edic environment here on Trek FM. And I think the Ready Room is a microcosm of that. You know, at any given week on the Ready Room, there might be a random mix of personalities that agree or disagree to some extent, largely based on random coincidence. But you can see how civil and enjoyable and positive we keep the discussions, even despite those sometimes deep disagreements. I think you're right, Chris, that the heart of edic is not that you always have to agree. And from my point of view, the heart of disagreement about controversial issues is not that you should always try to reconcile those disagreements. It's that you can agree to disagree and you can appreciate the perspective that someone else has and still keep a mutual respect in the discussion and keep it a friendly, positive discussion and not let those things devolve into an argument. So I think that's my only real response, that, you know, on Trek FM, we really do make a bona fide effort to try to keep this as respectful and civil, even despite some sometimes deep disagreements about, you know, the correct answers to those controversial issues or questions or topics.
Yeah. I think there is a perception sometimes from people who listen that we all agree on things maybe too much. And the misperception is that it's not that we always are agreeing on everything. It's just that unlike the norm in social media and on many podcasts and on radio and television and everywhere these days, we don't get into shouting matches about it. You know, we're not here to try to force someone else to accept our point of view. That's not our goal. Our goal is just to explore all the possible views. And oftentimes we see things the same way and sometimes we don't. But we just have a discussion. I don't know, Janet, if you listen to The Orb or not, but Deep Space Nine is the only show in the Star Trek universe that actually has religion built into the basic foundation of the show. And what's interesting between Matthew and me is that Matthew has a master's degree from seminary, and I'm atheist, and yet we're able to do this show and have, I think, wonderful discussions about it, even though we're coming at it from two very different points of views, because we have a great respect for each other, and we have a great respect for the material that we're talking about.
I think, Chris, I want to add that one thing that's unique about Trek FM and the way that our shows go, the way these discussions play out, whether it's on the air in a podcast episode or whether it's on the Babel conference, despite those deep disagreements, you mentioned that everyone respects each other. I think that's a huge part of it. You don't want to get into an argument with someone you don't respect. It's going to go downhill from there. But I think importantly, from our standpoint, we all like each other. It's amazing to find a group of 35 people that all really like each other, even despite their deep disagreements. Whether they're philosophical disagreements or personality differences, whatnot, we all like each other as people, and I hope that comes across when we do shows together.
Yeah, most definitely. So, Janet, thank you so much for your letter. And again, for anyone else, if you want to send us a message, we would love to hear from you. Trek.fm/contact, Facebook, the Babel Conference, and Twitter at TrekFM, and speakpipe.com/TrekFM are all the ways. I'd like to take one more quick moment here as we wrap up, Zachary, to thank our associate producers who support us through Patreon. And our associate producers for The Ready Room are, of course, Renee Roberts, who has been with the network from the very beginning. Trek FM would not be where it is right now, might not even be here at all, without the help that Renee has given us over the years. So thank you so much, Renee. And also, Sam Piasek is an associate producer of The Ready Room. Sam, we really appreciate your support of the show, helping us keep this coming out and supporting the network. Very much appreciated. And there's also some guy here named Zachary Fruling, who's an associate producer of the radio.
Who's that guy?
I don't know. I think some guy that likes to get philosophical about stuff.
Well, it's funny you mention that, Chris, because for me, getting involved with the network was kind of a progressive stage. I started out as a Trek FM listener, just listening to the podcast during my commute. Then I began donating to the network on Patreon, helping support the network financially. And of course, getting more and more involved, getting to know the people, it eventually led to participating in the Ready Room, being a guest panelist on the Ready Room, which I've done several times now. And now I have my own show with my co-host Mike Morrison, Metatreks. And it's a progression, but it all started with becoming invested in the network. As you become a faithful listener, you want to help us out, and it really does take time and effort and resources to put out these podcasts. It's very expensive to do what we do, and takes a lot of time and resources. So any help that people can give financially to the network and helps us bring great content to you each and every day. And it's amazing how much of that content we're producing now as a result of this investment and contributions that our listeners have.
Yeah, it really, really does. So if you would like to help us out, we would really appreciate it. If you go to patreon.com/TrekFM, that's patreon.com/TrekFM, you'll find everything that you need to know right over there. You'll find out about all the perks, find out how you can get on mic and talk Star Trek on the Patrons Roundtable. And who knows, in some situations, it does lead to guesting on shows, as Zachary did. It's unusual to get your own podcast, but you never know. We're always looking for good voices and good points of view. And also, you can get access to our exclusive website, Patron Zone, where we do early show releases from time to time. And we also have artwork and all kinds of things for you over there. And you can even become an associate producer, just like Sam and Renee and that Zachary guy. Again, you'll find it all over at patreon.com/TrekFM. And we really thank everyone who's supporting us there right now. Thank you so much, everyone. All right, Zachary, well, I'm going to wander back down to the holosuite, because I think once Nog left, Vic, he's a performer, it's what he does, and so I'm pretty sure he's going to be doing a new set.
Well, I'm going to go put on my Vic Fontaine records, and I think it's time to stick a martini with two olives in it, because the Ready Room is done.
It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be, but it wouldn't be